The sky that afternoon in Parisina was a brilliant blue. Brightly colored flowers, planted only by the hand of God, highlighted the hillsides.
As though a master painter had carefully chosen every one, which, of course, he had. The majestic Pilgrim Mountain stood in the background like an awesome monument, almost a protector, as it were, from the dangers that possibly lurked on the other side. Trees by now were a lush kind of green, and the tropical climate had produced vegetation of every form, until even the tall, healthy weeds that grew as high as man could see seemed to be a part of the master's plan, forming a kind of third dimension, as it were, to the pathways the natives had cut to go from village to village. Parisina, you see, was the end of the world. Even to the explorer, it was an off-limits kind of paradise seen only by those who dared fly overhead in some form of aircraft to view its beauty and simply wonder if there lurked below any form of human life. Only God knew. But of course God did. For wrapped in the foliage of God's camouflage were people he had created. People he longed to have to know his name, to understand his plan. They had no Bible. They had met no missionaries. They understood no theology. But it was as the Apostle Paul said it would be. Recall, he said in Romans chapter 1, the truth about God is known to them instinctively. God has put this knowledge in their hearts since earliest times. Men have seen the earth and the sky and all that God has made and have known of his existence and his eternal power. And it was true. The natives of that little self-encased world had always sensed the presence of something or someone greater than themselves. God had seen to that. They saw it in the majesty of the mountains. They saw it in the fury of the raging rivers. And they saw it in the consistency of the change of seasons as well. They, even in the vacuum in which they lived, knew that a master architect, one far greater than they, had upon the tablets of eternity sketched out a world for them to live in, and to them, that tiny world was all there was. Primitive was hardly an adequate word from our point of view. Here they were, without a book, without any means of communication, without any type of transportation, without any kind of information, even the knowledge that other people lived besides themselves. They'd never seen plumbing, never heard of electricity, never seen a clock, never been exposed to money or stores or things as we know them. And yet theirs was a self-contained existence that knew nothing else. Their pagan customs evolved simply from generations of superstition, and their manner of life was patterned only after traditions of their forefathers, for no foreign influence had dared to force its way into their protected little world. None, that is, until today. For this was the day the first human being from the outside world would set foot in this tropical paradise. Whether it would prove to be a blessing or a curse was still to be determined. Whether this intrusion into their self-satisfied world would be welcome or not, no one knew, but one thing was for sure, it was certain to come. Not by chance either, for because in a faraway land, in a place called America, a group of people who call themselves missionaries had been praying and planning for 7 years for the people of Parisina, should such a people exist. And the more they prayed, the greater became their burden. So for 84 months, they labored under the assumption that cradled beneath that dense cover of nature's green blanket was indeed a civilization, a people who needed to meet the God whose universe so clearly spoke his name. And so began their incredible journey into a land where no one had gone, to a people no one had seen. There were five of them altogether. There were the Jensens, Richard and Ellen, a young couple from the Midwest who'd spent the entirety of their lives on the mission field, he with his parents, she with hers, until they married 6 years before. And there were the Andersons, Beth and Alan, and their son, Rob. Now, Rob was 15. And taking him was the ultimate decision, a decision the mission board took over 2 years to make. But from previous experiences, they knew the value of the natives seeing the family unit together. And here was a young man, far more mature than most adults, one totally committed to giving his life, if need be, to take the message of the cross to a people whose vocabulary left no room for the word. There was, of course, no language to learn, because there was no way to know, even if there were a people there, what kind of dialect they would speak. But the families did spend a year studying the tongues of native tribes who were known to exist in those regions, just in case such similarities existed. Now, as the Jensens and the Andersons watched their plane land in this capital city of this land of contrast, they could not help but be awed at the difference between what they were seeing and what they were about to see. For as that giant aircraft lowered itself to the ground, they witnessed from the sky a portrait of a modern city, not at all unlike New York or Chicago or Dallas. Modern freeways stretched their circled limbs through the metropolis like the web of a mighty spider. Swimming pools, shopping centers, motels, at least for the moment, spelled out the image of a little America transported 10,000 miles from home. What a poor picture of life we glean from our first glimpse of a big city. What they were seeing was a plastic covering the world had placed over a sea of broken hearts and empty stomachs and dying souls. And what they were about to see was that only hours from this transplanted version of suburbia was a people who lived in a world that was frozen in a capsule of time thousands of years before. Now, which of these peoples would be the most likely to respond to that gospel message? That was a question unanswered for the moment. Nonetheless, one thing was sure: these two couples knew for sure to whom they had been sent. And they were reminded momentarily as their taxi sped through the winding streets of the city, dodging both motorcycles and donkeys, that both groups lived in jungles, so to speak, and neither understood anything else. It was an 18-hour drive to the outskirts of the unknown world to which they were headed. And all that was necessary to see a grown man run, they discovered, was to ask him to take them there. They offered to hire taxi drivers, bus drivers, and anyone else who seemed to have a vehicle capable of holding five Americans, their belongings wrapped in backpacks, and their seemingly indomitable spirits. But they had no takers. So that night, the Jensens and the Andersons spent most of their first evening in a country they longed to call home, on their knees praying for a miracle. The miracle was a God-provided vehicle and an individual willing to take them to the edge of the precipice, that the outer perimeters of the jungle they knew was going to lead them to the people for whom they prayed. Strangely enough, it was young Rob Anderson who seemed to sum it all up and make the rest of their prayers redundant. After what seemed like hours of intercession, it was Rob's turn to pray, and he simply prayed this way: "Dear Lord, you may be taking us to a whole new life. You may even be taking us to our death, which would be to real life. But Lord, whatever you're doing, you didn't send us to rot in a Holiday Inn. Give us the patience, Lord, to wait for the right person to come, and the vision, Lord, to see him when he comes. Thanks, Lord. You're wonderful. Amen." Well, nothing of substance could be added to a prayer like that. It was as like a burden had been lifted from the room, and the two families rose to their feet and began to sing hymns of praise, thanking God for whoever he'd send rather than fretting over if he would. Their singing, however, was interrupted by a knock on the door. The natural assumption that their joy had overflowed into the ears of those around them who were trying to sleep was allayed when the door was opened, only to find a young man, neatly dressed, with a smile that stretched all the way down the hall. His eyes were a mixture of alertness and compassion, and he seemed as though he already knew the two families, though to them he was a total stranger. It was only moments, however, before they realized that this ruddy-looking man, smiles and all, was an angel sent from God to deliver them to their destination. He was the pastor of a local church who'd been praying for 3 years that God would send missionaries to search out the hills of Parasena, looking for a people God had created who knew him not. as, quote, circumstances would have it, his son had been in the hotel lobby that afternoon and overheard the Jensens asking about transportation. So he was offering his services free to take them where they wanted to go. And then, chuckling, he added, his sovereign God had provided his church with a Toyota van only days before, obviously for this trip. And while his parents were still talking to their angel of transportation, Rob Anderson fell to his knees by his bedside and began to weep. Dear God, he prayed, how perfect are your ways. Remembering a lesson he'd learned years before about never forgetting to stop immediately to say thank you when God answers prayer. The next few days were filled with both excitement and activity. Pastor Ben, as they began to call him, arrived the next morning, Toyota and all, and their trek into the world of the unknown began to unfold so fast they were not even sure they were ready for it. But finally that Tuesday morning arrived when Ben, by now a faithful friend, had to say goodbye. For his Toyota had more than stretched the limits its creators in Japan had placed upon it when they advertised it would go almost anywhere. In fact, the grateful missionaries were more concerned about Ben and his new set of wheels making it back to the road than they were about their making their who knew how many days trip to the foot of that marvelous creation of God called Pilgrim Mountain. To describe the next few days as rugged would have been to have understated the situation considerably. By the third day, water was running low. Mosquitoes and crawling insects of every variety had become part of the family. And the intensity of the heat was far in excess of anything they experienced in training camp those summers before. Prayer times became times of just crying out to God for strength. Doubts began to form in their minds to tempt them, doubts that maybe these people they'd come to accept as so real didn't exist at all, and yet the thought of turning back never entered their minds. Even though they knew that every day they trudged further into that jungle, they were much less likely ever to return. And it had been made clear before they left, no area existed sufficient for a plane to land to rescue them. So on they went, five people with a mission, people with eyes so focused on one objective, their own safety, their own lives, were of no consequence. It was as the morning sun lifted its head off a pillow of clouds in the east that fifth day that 7 years of waiting came to an end. As Richard and Al were packing for another day's journey, suddenly they heard a rustling noise behind them. Al Anderson turned around with a start, and he began to speak, only to feel what appeared to be a hand covering his mouth and something as sharp as he had ever felt penetrating his side. With lightning-like speed, Rich, too, was grabbed, thrown to the ground, surrounded by 10 of the most ferocious-looking humans he'd ever seen on planet Earth. They were all tall, dark-complected, literally evil-looking men. Loincloths of some kind of animal skin were all the clothing they wore, other than the most hideous kind of wooden rings that protruded from their noses. The smell confirmed that at least to them, soap had not yet been invented in their world. And the grunts they exchanged, along with the glances that passed between them, immediately told one story, that this was no welcoming committee. They had indeed found the lost people of Parasena and had entered their lives as enemies, unwanted intruders into a private world never inhabited by a stranger before. It appeared to be only seconds before the whole group was awakened by the noise. The women screamed at first, simply out of fright, realizing that they'd rehearsed this over and over and screaming was not in the script. Nevertheless, the gruesomeness of the appearance of these men, who seemed to be almost half human, half animal, betrayed even the most extreme image formed in their mind these 7 years. And while they had spoken of danger and prayed about danger with all the calm of seasoned warriors, when the moment of truth arrived, faith gave way, at least for a second or two, to sheer panic. The next few hours cannot be described with pen and ink. So wrought with emotion they were, mixed emotions, blending of faith with fear, the merging the fulfillment of a dream with the reality the dream was becoming a nightmare. The men, including Rob, were bound with strong green vines and treated with a kind of roughness that indicated their lives or safety were of no value. The women, on the other hand, were treated as though they had some rare contagious disease. No one wanted to touch them, but still they were seen as enemies. The women tried to reason with the leader of the group using hand signals, but of course to no avail. They wanted to silence him, but their culture apparently included some inexplicable kind of respect for women, which simply wouldn't allow them to be harmed in any way. They were protective of the wives, but at arm's length. So they were urged to follow, which, of course, they did. The leader of the group was an angry-looking man whose eyes were alive with hostility and whose every movement defied anyone to resist. He moved around with such arrogance, you just knew for sure he'd somehow seen an old Jimmy Cagney or Humphrey Bogart movie and was trying to become Hollywood's next tough guy. Now, how they made the sharp objects that looked and felt like knives, nobody knew, but there was little doubt they could penetrate any animal that posed a threat or that was needed for food, and little doubt at this moment that they would be used on their intruders with no sense of remorse should there be one false move. The women continued to smile. They had been trained to do that. They smiled, and they very quietly sang hymns of praise as they were marched to their appointment with destiny. An appointment their God in his infinite wisdom had brought to reality at last. The walk was not a long one. Apparently the two families had camped that last night within a mile or so of that cluster of straw and bamboo shacks, as we would call them, that made up, believe it or not, the headquarters of the Parasena tribe. The sun was just beginning to release the intensity of its mid-morning brilliance when the two families were led captive into the lives of a people for whom they had prayed. Day after day after day. Their welcome was hardly overwhelming, but one thing was overwhelming, and that's the fact that these people really did exist. And the very way they moved and communicated left no doubt that they needed to know the God who created them, and they needed to know that he had redeemed them as well. The eyes of the two women darted about excitedly as they searched for and began to see emerge from those dried little huts real live women and children, lost women and children, whom a patient God had singled out and placed on their hearts 7 years before. These women had been praying for them almost by name, but of course they knew no names. But as the native women, frightened out of their wits at seeing these pale, strangely covered creatures who might be humans, began to surface, Ellen and Beth immediately began to feel their hearts break inside. And for a moment at least, their fear for their husband's safety melted into an ocean of compassion. They imagined in their own minds that what these women must be experiencing must have been more traumatic than the feelings we would have if a visitor from outer space landed on the roof of our church one Sunday, brought his family with 5 ears and 10 eyes apiece inside to worship. It became immediately obvious that the 5 uninvited guests who had appeared to alter the Parasenians' lifestyles for all eternity were being taken somewhere specific. It was one of those do-not-pass-go trips that make it clear there's no aimless wandering going on. And soon there loomed on the horizon another grass-and-stick dwelling, a good bit larger than the others, brightly colored paintings of some sort, paintings that looked strangely like huge butterflies hung on some kind of skins outside the hut. It could have been the butterfly diner, for all they knew, and they might have been headed for a steak dinner, but of course no one drew that conclusion. In fact, were there to be a steak dinner about now, it was almost obvious who would be the steaks. Our 5 visitors from another world were not prepared for what was inside that little hut. As they entered by way of a finely woven net, they were immediately attacked by a swarm of flying objects. Once their eyes adjusted to the light, however, they were able to see their attackers were simply a band of confined butterflies. Once past what must have been the butterfly room, they were led into another hut behind the first one on which a mound of dirt had been placed. And lo and behold, perched atop that mound was a man. A somewhat kindly-looking elderly man, believe it or not, and he too had one of those things sticking out of his nose that looked like it came out of a Cracker Jack's box. And atop his head was something that looked like it came out of an old Carmen Miranda movie, or if that's not familiar to you, something the Three Stooges might have dreamed up. It was a mixture of sticks, a mixture of skins, rather, dyed to get different colors and tied together with vines and sticks. Finally, the light dawned. This was their king. And that was his idea of a crown. Some basic concepts, you see, seem to work their way into any civilization, even one with no contact with the outside world. And this king, whom they later learned was called King Butterfly, made a sweeping movement with his right hand, indicating to the captors to loosen the vines that bound their captives, vines tied so tightly that circulation was beginning to disappear. And that, it seemed, was at least a start. And then the king, much to the chagrin of his subjects, ordered the others out of the room. Apparently, he saw these pale, strangely dressed intruders as harmless, or else he was a man of great bravery himself. Once the others had left the room, the king began to grunt incessantly. He was obviously trying to communicate, but none of the syllables even resembled the languages they had studied. All of the five sent ones, all that they knew to do then was to smile, simply praying they were not smiling at the wrong time. They were careful not to grin, they just smiled pleasantly. There was an eternal pause. And then King Butterfly's mouth began an upward turn, and he too began to smile. Al Anderson took his right hand, he pointed it up to the sky, and then he pointed to his heart, and he said, "God." Now, he knew that somewhat comically arrayed monarch didn't understand the word, but he wanted to start some kind of dialogue that might indicate why they were there. So he pointed again to the sky, and then to his heart, and then to the other four, and each time Butterfly would look up, stare into space, scratch his head, which must have been itching anyway from a combination of lice and that horrendous overweight laundry bag on his head. Then Al would smile, then the king would smile, and that would be that. Long periods of silence would be followed by repetition and then more silence. But each time Butterfly smiled, the missionaries felt a little relieved, and they continued to pray for this turban-topped ruler whom they now knew held the key to the hearts of the entire tribe. Finally, the king grunted loudly, and the 10 unfriendly messengers who'd fetched them returned to the room. Butterfly grunted again, pointed to Rob. Three of the men grabbed the boy and literally whisked him away before anyone could see what was happening. And then the old man spoke once more, and the other 7 strong men took the 4 remaining visitors and led them away to a straw hut not too far from Butterfly's palace and shoved them through the door. And then the leader of the group opened his mouth and with a big... and smiled a big semi-toothless grin. The grin let them know 2 things. A, they were not in immediate danger, and B, a dentist would be a welcome addition to the next team that came. Now, to say that the next few hours seemed long would hardly be adequate. In fact, the next 24 hours seemed longer than the 7 years it had taken them to get there. They knew nothing of what was happening to Rob, but somehow a mother's instincts told Beth Anderson that all was not well. And she began to weep and pray intermittently for her boy, pleading with God to protect him at first, and then quietly adding, "Nevertheless, thy will be done." She knew he would never want protection at the cost of the kingdom. She knew he would never want that he treasured the lives of these people he did not know more than he did his own. God seemed to have supernaturally given him that kind of commitment since his conversion 9 years before. Twice that day, 2 natives walked past the guards that were guarding their house of confinement and brought them, quote, food. Now, what it was they did not know at the time, but the men stood over them and simply sort of dared them not to eat it, so they eat it they did, forcing the most hypocritical smiles of their Christian lives. It was merely a meaty substance, a delicacy they later learned it was made of beetles and tree bark. One thing they could praise God for was that they didn't know that at the time. As the night passed, the hands on their watches seemed to move only a minute or two with every passing hour. The heat was unbearable as the natives had covered the windows with skins to keep the children from curiously looking in on these visitors from outer space. They prayed, they recited passages from the Psalms, and they claimed the promises God had given them 7 years before. One by one, finally, sleep overtook them, at least for a season, as a loving God seemed to tenderly place his hand under each of their heads on that straw-covered floor, gently close their eyes, and at least for a season, give them rest. They were awakened the next morning by the sound of a chanting crowd outside the hut. And whether they were coming to hang them or greet them, they didn't know, but one thing they did know, they were now the center of attention. Soon one of the guards opened the little shield of skins they used as a door and ushered them outside. It was a bright, hot morning, and the sun's reflection off the peak of Pilgrim Mountain seemed almost to give off a heavenly glow, as though God was about to reveal himself. The four missionaries were led in single file to King Butterfly's palace, followed by the chanting natives who kept crying, "Hill cow, hill cow, hill cow," a word they later learned meant life. Once they reached their destination, they stood motionless as the crowd chanted even more fervently, "Hill cow, hill cow, hill cow." Finally, the ruler, comical turban still atop his obviously bald head, emerged. He raised his right hand, and immediately there was total silence. It was almost as if God had spoken. Beth Anderson's eyes never stopped moving about, searching frantically for some sign of her son, but to no avail. Suddenly, there was a sound of shrieking and chanting a few yards away, and there emerged from another hut another group of natives, their whole bodies smeared with some kind of bright yellow substance, their heads covered with some kind of straw woven into tightly webbed saucers, and they were carrying a huge box of some sort made of dried lumber and tied together with thick green vines. The natives brought the box, laid it at King Butterfly's feet, and with one sweeping motion, he pointed to the sky, raised his voice to his limits, and cried, "Hill cow, hill cow, hill cow." And then his head fell, and he moved his arms, and all the natives fell to their knees. And he simultaneously did two things. He opened that wooden box, and he flung open the door of his butterfly room, releasing all of the butterflies at once. Beth Anderson fainted. The other three missionaries fell on their faces, weeping. For inside that box was the body of Rob Anderson. He was now in the presence of Jesus. What they had done, they did not know. That he was dead, they knew. Little by little, the pieces began to fit together in their grief-torn minds. Even in their self-enclosed pagan world, these people believed that out of death came life. So this king, who thought he had discovered this principle, collected caterpillars and spent his whole life waiting for them to emerge into something beautiful. And when they did, he would hold them captive until once a month the natives would kill an animal and using that as a sacrifice, they would release the butterflies, signifying new life, shouting, "Hill cow, hill cow, hill cow." Even in their ignorance, they grasped the concept that life came from another source, from above, and that sacrificing something alive somehow pleased whoever it was in the sky who gave that life. Amazing. So every time someone died, an animal was killed in hopes that the death of one would give life to another. But one other concept had crept into their minds as well. Somehow it was the concept that one person could die in the place of others. And so whenever a member of one of the tribes wanted to join another, someone had to be killed so the others would be accepted. That sacrifice would usually be the son of the one who wanted to join the tribe. King Butterfly did not know from whence these white men had come, but when they pointed to heaven, he assumed they wanted to join his tribe and that they had brought a son to be sacrificed in their place. So a sovereign God had prepared their hearts to understand his plan in ways no human mind can comprehend. Beth Anderson, even in her grief, could not help but remember what day it was. For had they been at home that day, they would have been pressing Easter clothes and readying for a big Sunday at church. It was Good Friday, the day Christians remember another time when one life was given as a sacrifice for another. The king, witnessing their grief, was momentarily stunned and then recovered. He ushered them into the empty butterfly room and began grunting unceasingly. Al Anderson, heaving with grief inside, forced a gentle smile, and he reached out his hand to the puzzled king. The king, not knowing what a handshake was, drew Al's hand to his heart to indicate he wanted to be his friend. He saw something in these strangers, something more than a different colored skin and weird-looking clothes. He saw a hidden love in their eyes he'd never seen before, a love he'd been searching for all of his life. Using hand motions, Al Anderson, holding back the tears, kept pointing to the lifeless body of his son. And then he would point to heaven. And then he would motion with his arms as though they were surrounding someone, and he would quietly say, "Resurrection." Now, why he chose that word, only God knows. He pointed to heaven again, and then he pointed to that entire crowd gathered curiously outside his hut as if to indicate someone had died already for all of them. And then he would whisper it again, resurrection. And then Al pointed to one lone butterfly who somehow missed his escape cue and was flitting helplessly about the room. And he opened the door and let him go free. And as he did, he whispered once more, resurrection. Trying to demonstrate that though Rob's body was dead, Rob was alive. Now you know and I know, there's no any way, humanly speaking, two people who cannot speak a word of each other's language can communicate something as profound as the gospel. You know and I know. But that's humanly speaking. When God begins to speak to a heart, beloved, the words men use are not the issue. And God was speaking through the death of a godly young man to the heart of a searching native, a native who held the key to the hearts of a whole tribe of men and women God desperately wanted to redeem. The four remaining missionaries were led back to their hut. And for the next 2 days, they wept and they prayed. They were given no food, they saw no people, they heard no sounds. They were, as it were, in solitary confinement. Hunger was not an issue in their grief. Food was the last thing on their minds. Again and again, they kept remembering Rob's words in that motel room as he prayed, Lord, you may be taking us to our death. That would be real life. And they kept remembering the passage in John 18 where Caiaphas counseled the Jews that it was expedient for one man to die so that many would be saved. Should even one Parasinian native find Christ through Rob's death, they knew Rob would be in heaven praising God for the privilege of dying that others might live. They knew that. And that thought brought a great deal of comfort to Al and Beth Anderson, a comfort that lived on with them through the years. Every time a native said yes to Christ. It was 2 days later, early in the morning, when the doors of the hut were loosened and the two couples, totally at peace now with their God, ready, if he deemed it proper to die as Rob had, were ushered into the sunlight once again. Standing before them, the crown no longer atop his head, was King Butterfly. He was surrounded by literally hundreds of natives, obviously his tribe and others as well. The absence of the crown was puzzling at first, but soon they came to understand, for as they walked into the center of that waiting mob, suddenly the king raised his hands to the sky, and pointing to heaven, he shouted at the top of his voice in crudely formed words, resurrection! 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 And soon the whole crowd of natives began chanting at the top of their lungs, resurrection! 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 And as they were shouting, King Butterfly turned around and picked up his once famous crown and laid it at the feet of Al Anderson. And he pointed to the heavens, indicating that he was no longer worthy to wear that crown. He didn't understand it all, that much is sure, but something inside of him had revealed there was a real king somewhere, someone who had given his own son once and for all for the sins of the world. Don't try to explain it, you can't. But glory in it, beloved, this man understood resurrection. Beth Anderson began to glow with an excitement she simply could not contain. Two thoughts flooded her mind. One was a picture of her son Rob kneeling at the feet of Jesus, shouting in unison with the natives. And the other was the realization that this was Easter Sunday. Here they were, 10,000 miles from home, standing before people who never heard the gospel before, having a sunrise service with a whole choir of natives singing, resurrection, resurrection. Oh, dear God, she prayed, how great thou art. The Andersons miss their son, beloved, but somehow they understand now more than ever before the price their precious God paid to bring eternal life to fallen men. And somehow that personal understanding has given them a joy they never had before. 4 years have passed now, and once again it's Easter Sunday. As the morning sun begins its ministry of light, literally hundreds of smiling natives are gathered inside that enlarged butterfly shack, which now houses what you and I would call the First Evangelical Church of Parisina. And there the Jensens and the Andersons, as they do every Sunday, teach Sunday school class in a native tongue they are finally beginning to master. And then Pastor Butterfly, if you will, a simple servant now of the King of Kings, rises and begins to preach. It's a simple message, but nonetheless profound. For he speaks of a God who loved a people so much that he gave his only Son as a once-for-all sacrifice for sin, so that all anyone would have to do was accept that Son and invite him into their hearts. Do that, Pastor Butterfly concluded, and it will be Easter. Then the kindly old man's eyes turned, and they met the eyes of Al and Beth Anderson, and a look of love overwhelmed them. At that time, the congregation begins to chant once again, "Resurrection, resurrection, resurrection." The entire congregation, that is, plus one. For up in heaven, where it is always Easter, one Rob Anderson, accompanied by a choir of angels, is joining in the celebration, singing, "Resurrection, resurrection, resurrection." One of these days, beloved, if you're a Christian, you too will be gathered around God's throne with the angelic host singing his praises forever. And you just might come across a quartet of very happy people with their arms around each other singing a resurrection song. Stop and ask them their names, won't you? It will probably be a lad named Rob, joyfully reunited with his mom and his dad at last, and his wonderful friend, a man named Butterfly. Chances are they may just keep singing resurrection for all eternity. And you may want to stop for a while and join them. Because, beloved, for you and for them, resurrection will be complete at last. God bless you, and have a blessed resurrection day.
You've been listening to a message by Russell Kelfer, founder and director of Discipleship Tape Ministries of San Antonio, Texas. Feel free to contact us on the World Wide Web at www.dtm.org. That's dtm.org. Or you may write to us at the following address: Discipleship Tape Ministries, 10602 Moss Bank, San Antonio, Texas, and the zip is 78230. Well, thank you for listening. We pray God's richest blessing may be yours as He continues to live His life in you.